Greetings and welcome back for the third hour of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Here in this hour, a two-part conversation, in fact, with the author of our Issues Etc. book of the month for June, Reasonable Ethics, A Christian Approach to Social, Economic, and Political Concerns, Dr. Richard Benny. First, we're going to talk about sexual ethics, and I think we'll begin using an example from Dr. Benny's own church body, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, that, like so many of the other mainline Protestant denominations in the United States, have really taken a turn in about the last decade on the issue of how the church addresses sexual ethics, especially in the culture and then even in their own ranks. And then at the half hour, we're going to change the subject to culture and entertainment, the nexus between faith and society when it comes to, well, if you think about it, culture and entertainment takes up better than half of our day for most of us. If you watch as much television, sit at the internet, go to the movies, or however else you entertain yourself like the rest of us do. That's the conversation for this third hour of Issues Etc. Dr. Robert Benny is Professor Emeritus of Religion and Director of the Center for Religion and Society at Roanoke College and author of our Issues Etc. book of the month for June, Reasonable Ethics. Dr. Benny, welcome back.
Good to be here.
If you would, cite the example of your own church body, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, about 5 years ago thereabouts, officially started to rethink sexual ethics, especially as it pertains to society and how they're going to deal with it within the church. Tell us about it.
Well, it's a much longer process than that, and it's a long story, but I'll try to cut it short. Even before the merger that created the ELCA in 1988, there was quite a bit of agitation to re-examine the traditional Christian teaching on homosexuality, or homosexual conduct is more exact way to put it. And that has gradually built, that movement to re-examine or even revise traditional Christian teachings has gradually grown with more and more power in the ELCA. And brought forward in the churchwide assembly last summer some proposals through the church council to ordain partnered gays and lesbians under some circumstances, under a special procedure to certify. And the second issue being the blessing of gay and lesbian unions. And while the traditional teachings were formally kept or publicly kept, the church seemed to allow a wide degree of flexibility in terms of pastoral care without any sort of guidelines or any sort of discipline in the matter of pastoral care. So the church didn't go over the edge of the abyss last August. Many people who would have been willing to ditch the ELCA didn't, because they thought in some sense the status quo was held. The effort to ordain gays and lesbians in partnered relationships under a special procedure was defeated. That needed two-thirds vote, and it wasn't even close to that. But still, it was close to a half-and-half vote. So these things are bubbling up in the ELCA just as they're bubbling up in the Episcopal and Presbyterian Church. Both the Episcopal and Presbyterian seem to have moved further than the ELCA in terms of revising Christian sexual teachings.
I guess just a matter of opinion from you before we talk about this as a more general issue. Are you optimistic that the ELCA, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, will be able to restrain itself where the Episcopal Church USA, Presbyterian Church USA, and a few others haven't seemed able to?
Well, I think, no, I'm not very optimistic over the long run, because the headquarters culture is very much moving in this direction. There are very, very strong lobbying groups and organized groups in the ELCA pressuring toward revision. And perhaps the most disturbing thing is probably the new clergy coming out of the seminaries are much more liberal and permissive on this particular issue. So in the long run, I think it will fall, and probably will lead to something of a diminishment of the ELCA. People will leave.
You wrote that the ELCA in general acts as if it has no normative tradition on Christian sexual ethics. What do you mean by that?
Well, very curious thing. When the ELCA came into being as a new church, the predecessor body's social statements were held as normative. And that is supposed to be the way it is. And in theory, it is that way. But when we got into the big debate about homosexual conduct, the church acted as if there were no normative traditions that had to be overturned, that all of these were kind of equal on the same level, and one could argue for one or the other. And it seems to me that the predecessor church's commitments on this were very important, as is the universal church's commitments on these issues, and that would take an enormous amount of evidence and argumentation to overturn these traditional teachings. And ELCA was acting as if there wasn't any normative tradition, but that, you know, one could just pick among these equal contenders.
It seems, I've noticed this, because, of course, during the summer church assembly season that we run to, we've got the Episcopal Church USA in Columbus, Ohio, the Presbyterian Church USA, even the Unitarian Universalists were here in St. Louis this last week. So every church seems to be a gathering and assembly. There is kind of a strained naivete, a very affected kind of a thing when a church considers, say, ordaining active homosexuals or permitting same-sex marriage, and someone objects. They act as though that objection is sometimes they act as though that objection is unexpected. What are you worried about? We're not trying to do anything unusual here, and it seems rather strange to me, Dr. Benny.
Well, it is rather strange. I mean, I for one would have never wanted this issue to come up. And conservatives or the Orthodox on this issue are often placed in the position of seeming like they're reactionaries, or they have initiated this whole discussion. Of course, they haven't. The people who want to revise have initiated it. And often there's an intimidating power of the revisionists that silence the traditionalists. And in fact, at the parish level, at the lay level, there are large majorities holding to the traditional Christian teachings. But at the elite level, you get just the reverse. And it's very difficult, sometimes takes quite a bit of courage, to speak up for the traditional Christian sexual teachings.
You talk later in this section on sexual ethics about how the cultural props that reinforced what the church may have believed and assented to, but didn't actively teach, like the immorality of cohabitation, the immorality of adultery, how marriage is really an institution of God, all these things that they believed but didn't necessarily teach. What happened when those cultural props, when the culture stopped reinforcing the church's beliefs on that?
Well, the people in the churches began accommodating to the cultural trends. And so we've got in the churches people who simply haven't been formed in the classical Christian view of Christian sexual ethics, and they more or less follow the culture. So that's not totally true. If one looks at the intense people of any denomination, even the liberal denominations, there tends to be more of an adhering to traditional Christian ethics. But as a whole, people have more or less accommodated culture, and it's very easy to accommodate to when you look at the popular culture around us, the TV that young people watch every night, when you think of the popular music that they listen to and the teen culture. It's very, very difficult to go against the flow, as it were, but that's what Christians are called to do.
Do you think the church in general has taken the cultural shift on sexual ethics seriously enough?
Not at all. I don't think there's serious teaching on Christian sexual ethics. And here we're not talking about primarily homosexual sex. We're talking about an ethic for the vast majority of us heterosexual Christians, perhaps 98-99% of the people. And while we often get overly focused on homosexual issues, meanwhile the depredations or the immorality of the vast majority don't go unchecked. And one can think of premarital sex, one can think of fidelity in marriage, one can think of abortion, one can think of cohabitation. All these issues the mainstream churches have not addressed with their young in any kind of systematic fashion.
Can you answer the chicken or egg question on this? I mean, since our general conversation has to do with the churches and the Christians' place in society, was the cultural shift the result of the church not teaching strongly enough the proper biblical sexual ethic, or was the cultural shift going to happen anyway and the church just succumbed?
Oh, I think the cultural shift was going to happen. It was a building through the 50s, way back into the 40s, and when you get vast affluence in a context of freedom, it's perhaps a melancholy fact of history that morals become more lax and permissive, and then the society tends to degenerate. And I think that's what we've been party to, and then it was vastly accelerated in the great revolutions of the 60s, particularly the liberationist impulses in the sexual revolution, were very potent, and in fact, those were perhaps the most far-reaching effects of the 60s revolution is in the realm of sexuality. One could argue that politics had been reverted to more sanity. However, in the culture, sexual ethics and the liberation impulses have been enormously effective, and it's those kinds of trends that have been able to flourish in the context of affluence and freedom that now we see in its profusion in the internet culture, that's been a formidable kind of development that the churches have more or less stuck their heads in the sand and allowed their children perhaps to just go along with the flow.
We're talking with Dr. Robert Benny, Professor Emeritus of Religion and Director of the Center for Religion and Society at Roanoke College, about sexual ethics. In the next half hour, we'll continue our conversation with him on culture and entertainment. He's author of our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for June. It's called Reasonable Ethics, A Christian Approach to Social, Economic, and Political Concerns. Then let's talk about the foundation of the church's sexual ethic, beginning with what you talk about, marriage as a Christian calling.
Well, the foundations, of course, for Christians are from the Old Testament, Genesis, where God establishes the primal, the first covenant, a human covenant, in which he offers Adam and Eve the opportunity to enter into holy marriage. And there, the fundamental themes are established for Christians. And then Jesus, in the Gospel of Mark, reaffirms these themes and radicalizes them, makes them even more difficult in terms of divorce to get out of. So those are the fundamentals from the Bible, and then the Christian tradition developed over 1,000 years and has a great deal of consensus on what the Christian sexual ethic ought to be, based fundamentally upon the idea of marriage, on the covenant of marriage. So, as C.S. Lewis put it, the Christian ethic is rather simple but quite challenging. Sex is to be within the holy covenant of marriage between a man and a woman, nothing outside, and fidelity inside.
You're right. I mean, it's extremely simple to articulate. And I guess with regard to our conversation, the real hard question is, how then does the church's sexual ethic, which really, I mean, if we understand it correctly, is not just a Christian thing, it's a universal thing. Marriage is a universal institution, Christian and non-Christian. How does the church's interests in marriage and family extend into the society, given the fact that marriage exists outside the church too?
Well, in the West, there's a remarkable tracing of the Christian sexual ethic or marriage ethic from the very beginning. One can trace how that affected the culture of the West and the laws of the West. There's a marvelous book by John Witte Jr. from Emory University called From Sacrament to Contract, which is a whole history of marriage in the West, and he shows how each great Christian religious tradition had a vision of marriage that it implanted not only in the culture but in the laws of the land. In America, that was very powerful, from the Puritans in the Northeast and the Anglicans in the South and the Catholics in the mid-Atlantic colonies. There was a great consensus about what marriage was, and those were embodied in the laws of America up until the 1960s. And so what we have now is a gradual dismantling of the laws that were an inheritance of the Christian civilization of America, and transforming those laws based upon the covenant, a social, great social institution that all participate in, but it has theological foundations, the transformation of that into contracts, which anybody can enter in, and conceivably any number of people can enter into. And so we're beginning to see this symptoms of what this transformation is all about. When you get the movement for gay marriage, and then very quick upon its footsteps is the movement toward polyandry, or polyamory, as it's called.
That kind of explains why the homosexual lobby outside the church have often said, look, we want marriage, same-sex marriage, but we're not going to require the churches to recognize this thing. They can still do their sacrament or their rites and rituals the way they want to. We're not going to require the churches to recognize this thing. We just want the recognition of society. But can the two so neatly be divorced from one another?
I don't think so. There certainly can be some accommodations in a secular pluralistic society, but Christians have every right as citizens to enter the public sphere with all their religious notions, religiously based moral notions, and argue and agitate for a substantive public policy. So what we're seeing now in the great debate on the marriage amendment, which for the moment is dead at the federal level, but at the state level certainly not dead, you get Christians arguing that this is not only good for the church, not only does it help the church and Christians flourish, but it's good for the society. So Christians and Lutherans can make the argument that in the left-hand kingdom, there is God's law is still relevant, and God's law should be followed, even though they may use different language to make their arguments. And Christians have every right and perhaps a duty to maintain a decent moral arrangement in society. So a lot of Christians are involved in maintaining a traditional notion of marriage in the public sphere.
Is it wise for Christians, when they make that public square argument, to approach it from an explicitly Christian standpoint? I mean, should they say, God instituted marriage, marriage is God's invention, we can't tamper with God's invention?
Well, I don't think it's terribly wise to do that. Not in principle it isn't, because sometimes in extreme situations one has to say we will obey God rather than man. But in political situations, I think it's better to follow, to make arguments that are more broadly based. The Catholics use natural law arguments. Lutherans can talk about civil righteousness and the law in kind of rational or experiential language. So I think, and there have been many, many great arguments based on empirical research and upon natural law kinds of ethics made by the proponents of marriage between a man and a woman in the public sphere. The Princeton theses, for example, are a magnificent example of that being done. So I think Christians can, probably strategically, should make commonly based rational arguments.
What's at stake here, especially when it comes to marriage and its survival as a particularly defined institution in society?
Wow, a lot is at stake, because it's almost universally recognized now that breakups of families or single parenthood have terrific negative effects on children, and a high percentage of the young people in prison are from fatherless families and broken families, and the toll is just incredible when you have a breakup of the family. And as you move to this contractual notion of marriage, that marriage is rather easy to get into and rather easy to get out of, and marriage becomes a very fragile thing, and that has repercussions in the society all the way up and down. One of the hardest things to argue in an individualistic American society is that these social changes will actually harm your marriage over the long run, or the marriage of your children over the long run. One of the easy outs that people say is, well, how can gay marriage hurt my marriage? Well, it won't in any direct sense, but over the long run, and in general, tampering with this fundamental covenantal structure in social life, tampering with it and degrading it to contractual status will have terrible effects on our society, I believe.
You have then again mentioned the whole degeneration of marriage from a covenantal to a contractual arrangement. What do you make of the compromise that some seek when it comes to same-sex marriage, and that is the same-sex unions or the civil union, which is applicable to both same-sex couples and differing-sex couples? What do you make of same-sex unions?
You mean of civil unions?
Yes.
Well, you mean something like common law marriage?
Let's say for the gay couple, trying to gain all the rights, privileges of marriage via a kind of a civil contract rather than calling it
marriage. I see
marriage.
What you mean. Yeah. So civil unions, in essence. Well, I think most of those legal capacities or legal amenities can be reached already without having to have civil unions, like inheritance or visitation in the hospitals, determination of medical care. All those things can be established legally without establishing social unions. The only way I would be for social unions would be if they were non-sexually based, that is, others could enter into these unions too, like a mother and a father living together. But that would be enormously expensive, and you would have to expand your entitlements, legal entitlements, terrifically. So I'm generally opposed to social unions or civil unions across the boards.
Then with only 1 minute, in fact, less, what do you think about the movement for safe sex?
Safe sex?
Yes.
Well, I think the Africans that are having success in fighting AIDS and HIV have it right. First, you really work at abstinence and building up an ethic of fidelity and marriage only with sex only within marriage. But then, as a fallback, you talk about condoms and other ways of avoiding these diseases or pregnancy. But I'm all in favor of the emphasis on abstinence. I hate that word. It sounds negative, doesn't it? But faithfulness or fidelity in marriage or sex in marriage is the best approach I think we can take.
Well, when we come back from this break, we're going to turn to the subject of culture and entertainment with Dr. Robert Benny, Professor Emeritus of Religion and Director of the Center for Religion and Society at Roanoke College. He's author of our Issues, Etc. book of the month for June, called Reasonable Ethics, A Christian Approach to Social, Economic, and Political Concerns. This book is $14.99 plus shipping and handling. If you'd like to find out more about it, one of two ways. You can call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or you can find Reasonable Ethics at our homepage, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. It's the Issues Etc. book of the month for June by our guest in this last hour of Issues Etc., Dr. Robert Benny. Reasonable Ethics, A Christian Approach to Social, Economic, and Political Concerns. When we come back, we'll talk about culture and entertainment.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Every day, every Christian is faced with a myriad of ethical decisions, both small and large. Political ethics, economic ethics, sexual ethics, cultural ethics. Many of these situations are clearly addressed in God's Word of Holy Scripture. Many of them are not. So what is a Christian to do? The title of our Issues Etc. book of the month for June is Reasonable Ethics, A Christian Approach to Social, Economic, and Political Concerns by Robert Benny. You can order Reasonable Ethics by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, and you can find out more about the book by going to our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. Look for the Issues Etc. book of the month for June, Reasonable Ethics, right there at our homepage, issuesetc.org.
McKillie-Mimby, what on earth is that?
Answers with Ken Ham.
one of the lecturers at the highly popular Answers in Genesis seminars. Well, Ken Makili Mimembe sounds like the name of a basketball star I watched on TV just a few nights ago. It's the name, though, of a dinosaur that may be alive today, right, Ken?
Well, yes, and according to eyewitness accounts by natives in the Congo and Central Africa, there seems to be a distinct possibility that a living dinosaur, which they call Makili Mimembe, is roaming about in their jungles. Maybe the Jurassic Park movies were partly right after all. Also, natives in the rainforests of Brazil have reported seeing a red-haired creature that some scientists now believe is a ground sloth. You know, these sloths supposedly became extinct 10,000 years ago. There are so many such reports from around the world like these. In fact, so much so that a special organization has been created to look for these creatures to determine if they're still alive. And as they find creatures that were supposed to have become extinct thousands or millions of years ago, the more embarrassing it is to evolution. Creationists, of course, have no problems at all when such creatures are found. Makili Mimembe, well, it could be a living dinosaur, which, of course, fits with what the Bible says in the book of Genesis. God created all land creatures, which included dinosaurs, on day six.
What does the Bible have to say about dinosaurs? Well, it's very different than what you'd see in Hollywood movies. Read Ken Ham's free booklet on dinosaurs on our award-winning website, AnswersRadio.com. It's free at AnswersRadio.com.
Todd Wilkin here, talking with Dr. Dean Wenthe, president of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Dr. Wenthe, tell us about Concordia Theological Seminary as a worldwide outreach.
We have, at latest count, about 23 different countries represented on our campus. We have a full-time staff member teaching in Lithuania, another in Siberia, and then our resident faculty teaches regularly in Kenya, in Haiti. We just recently received an invitation to teach in Madagascar. So our commitment is to be a light on the hill and to broadcast the light of Christ into all the world.
For more information about Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, visit them on the web at www.ctsfw.edu.
Everybody wants a quick answer to a healthy lifestyle. On the next Focus on the Family, Dr. Paul Reiser tells Dr. James Dobson it's a one-day-at-a-time process. There's no magic bullet to lowering cholesterol or a get-thin-quick program that's worth the money. Instead, nutritional and exercise programs that change the heart and mind are the most successful. That's all on the next Focus on the Family.
Weekdays at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back for the last half hour of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking with Dr. Robert Benny. He's author of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, Reasonable Ethics. We're turning from the subject of sexual ethics to something that actually, if you think about it, is pretty closely related, since a lot of our entertainment is woven through with sexual innuendo. Just look at primetime television. Now, we'll get to that subject in a few minutes, but my first question for Dr. Benny has more to do with why we feel the compulsion to entertain ourselves at such outrageous levels, not only in terms of time, but in terms of the content of our entertainment. Dr. Benny, how would you answer that? We are an entertainment-saturated and addicted culture.
Well, that's true, and one of the disturbing things, or one of the things that makes you really think, is that one of our greatest exports now is not steel or agricultural goods, but entertainment. And when you think of the content of our entertainment, you can understand why some societies around the world wonder about us. I think perhaps the entertainment is not a terribly accurate indicator of the way people really live, but it's kind of disgusting to see what actually is portrayed about the way Americans live.
Why do you think Americans not only export it, but consume the frivolous, even to be generous, I enjoy it as much as the next guy, but the frivolous in such amazing quantities?
Well, it's a function, I believe, of the widespread affluence and the freedom that people have to do whatever they wish. And it reverts back to the conversation we had last half hour that when you have this much freedom and this much affluence, you're going to get a lot of trivial stuff, a lot of superficial stuff. And it throws people back upon resources that are very important in order to live well. And that's where Christianity comes in, it seems to me. We, as Christians, should be formed strongly within the Christian tradition so we can make wise choices about our entertainment and our and in the culture.
In ancient societies, and I'm thinking here mostly of the Greek and Roman societies, athletics, one of their major forms of entertainment, was fraught through with religious connotations. There were entire games dedicated to the honor of the gods, and then the honor of gods was supposed to accrue to those who were victorious in sport. Is there any role for religion in one of our major venues of entertainment in our culture, and that is athletics, professional sports?
Well, I think one thing, religion's role in athletics is to call it into question as an idol in our society. And in a society of leisure and entertainment, as we've talked about earlier, there's a great tendency of sports to become idolatrous, to claim too much of our time, too much of our energy, too much of our loyalty. And one sees that now in the way children are brought up often, where they're ushered from one organized sports activity to the next, and it takes up way too much of the time, often crowds out religious activities. When one looks upon the hype and the exaggerated importance given sports, probably Christians ought to be a little critical about this.
Is it a quasi-religious aspect of our culture, the fact that we can fill our churches about half full every Sunday, but we can fill a stadium to overflowing every Sunday?
Well, if you take the total number of people going to church on a Sunday morning, it still dwarfs what American pro football can do on a Sunday afternoon. And I'm a great sports fan myself, so I have to be careful about what I say here to keep from being hypocritical. But certainly, the devotion to certain teams and persons is certainly pseudo-religious or crypto-religious. I'm from Nebraska, and boy, if you...
Cornhuskers.
The Cornhuskers. I mean, when there's a game in Lincoln, the whole state stops, and there's such passion, intensity, and commitment, it's got to be seen as partially religious.
What about religious expression within the sports themselves? All the way from high school games, that it's considered kind of a matter of course that the coach will pray with the team in the locker room, or that there'll be a public prayer before, or that... there will even be religious gestures on the part of the participants in the sports throughout the game.
Well, I think that's a fascinating question. And on the one hand, I'm delighted that people publicly show that they're Christians in these areas of life. And I certainly approve of that a lot more than the chest thumping or the self-glorification that goes on in sports. At least if you point to heaven after a touchdown, it's better than pointing to yourself. But so there's a healthy place for religion. I think the prayers that are done, if they pray for doing well, if they pray for their opponents, they pray for not getting hurt, all these sorts of things are perfectly okay, it seems to me, and there is a place for religion of that sort. But I get pretty nervous when I see sport being used to kind of congratulate oneself or to manipulate God. That's perhaps the most disturbing part, when people make the sign of the cross before they bat when they make the point to heavenward when they score a touchdown. Now, one could say, well, that's being grateful to God for the gift he's given me. But then you got to ask, well, why did God bestow a touchdown on this side and not the other side? Is God that interested in who's going to be winning? It looks a little bit more like the manipulation of God.
For those Christians who are involved in either entertainment as athletics as entertainment or the other forms we're going to talk about here in this half hour, the theater and movies and music and the others, can Christians rightly understand their... if they actually are participants in these things, their artistry and their athletics as a godly vocation?
Oh, certainly. I think given the importance of sports and given the importance of entertainment, as we talked about a little earlier, what a magnificent place for Christians not only to do their calling well, as Luther enjoyed we should, but to first give off great human characteristics, human values expressed, like humility, like generosity, like giving the other, the opponent, their due, all these sorts of things, but also then to find ways of specific Christian witness in their calling. And I think that would have to do with the kinds of materials they do, the kind they won't do, the kinds of things they can say about their calling when they're given the chance. There are all sorts of wonderful things, and I appreciate so much Christians when they take their calling seriously in entertainment and sports.
A regular guest we have on this program, Brian Gadawa, is a screenwriter out in Hollywood, California, and he wrote a book some years back called Hollywood Worldviews, Watching Films with Wisdom and Discernment. Do we need more of this from a Christian perspective and a Christian worldview, instructing Christians as consumers of these major forms of our culture and entertainment on how they ought to go about that and what they ought to be wary of, what they ought to look for?
Oh, I certainly think so. I wrote a book myself called Seeing is Believing, Visions of Life Through Film, where I try to show how deeply embedded in movies is a view of life, a vision of life, and that there are Christian ones around. Often they are implicitly Christian because many times the Christian story is just a very, very good story, and non-Christians will pick up on those stories and make wonderful movies out of them. So, but we give very little time over with our young in school, even in public schools or in colleges or in the church, to helping young people make discerning judgments about what to watch and then how to discern or how to interpret what they watch. These are enormously influential venues now for people, movies, videos, and music. I can't purport to say much about music, but I'm quite interested in movies. And these perhaps have more effect on the young than their reading. So we should pay a lot more attention to it, I believe.
Well, if you don't mind saying, what was the last film that you watched that struck you as particularly, you know, the kind of film where you're watching, you say, now that's something every Christian probably ought to see?
Well, let's see. I offer, of course, what is the last one? Of course, The Passion of Christ. Passion of the Christ was a magnificent movie that I think was also controversial, but that Christians ought to see, where you get the fundamental story itself. Now, I'm trying to think of recent movies that I've seen that would exhibit this underlying Christian story, and I'm coming up blank right for the moment. Sorry.
What about the ones that have been billed kind of by Christians for Christians? And I'm thinking here in particular not just Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ, but most recently The Chronicles of Narnia.
Oh,
there's,
yeah.
There seems to be now kind of a hey, Christians spend money at the theaters too, and let's tap into that dollar, or am I being too cynical?
No, I think there is that element. Hollywood wants to make money, and if they believe they can make money by giving more religious fare, they will do that. But The Chronicles of Narnia is a wonderful example of good Christian material that, as you know, an allegory can be interpreted at various levels. But that's high-quality Christian entertainment. Some of the movies done by Christians, unfortunately, just like the music they do, is of low quality and kind of hackneyed. So I think the great challenge for Christians is to step up there with the very best of movie makers and do their thing.
You also talk about culture, and I think culture is one of those terms that we toss out as a grab bag for a whole myriad of things. How would you define it?
Well, I believe culture is the system of meanings and values that are the guidance system of a society. And these are shared meanings and shared values that are extremely important, because law and coercion cannot guide a society or even keep it under wraps, one counts on a great deal of shared meanings and values to make a society hold together, but also to guide it in a wholesome fashion. So culture is extremely important. Conservatives generally like to locate the problems of society in the culture, whereas liberals tend to see the problems as unjust economic arrangements or lack of political power. But I believe, and I guess I'm a conservative, that the fundamental level of culture is the most important. If one has a good cultural inheritance from your family and are participating in a good culture, that is meanings and values and practices, one makes one's way in society pretty well, even if you're an immigrant and even if you begin poor. But if you don't have that good culture, a good cultural inheritance through your family, it will be very difficult for you in the society.
I'm Todd Wilkin. You're listening to Issues Etc. We're talking with Dr. Robert Benny, author of Our Issues Etc., Book of the Month for June, Reasonable Ethics about Culture and Entertainment. He's Professor Emeritus of Religion and Director of the Center for Religion and Society at Roanoke College. And we've got about another 10 minutes left in our conversation. Culture, almost by definition, changes. I mean, it is a living thing. It's a product, both the product of our values, but also a shaper of our values. How would you track the general cultural change in the last century here in the United States?
Oh, that's a big question.
I mean, has it changed as much as, I mean, technology has obviously changed, which brings cultural change.
Sure.
A person born, I heard an interview with 94-year-old famous radio Studs Terkel.
Yeah.
Just the other day, and I'm thinking to myself, this man was born before most people had electricity, plumbing, before the car, before everything. And what has this man seen? I wonder how you would track that cultural change there that seems from that perspective to be revolutionary, unbelievable, especially its pace.
Certainly, the technology has changed. The economy's changed enormously. Social structures have changed a good deal. So one would expect the culture to change, but I believe cultural change is perhaps the slowest, and culture is perhaps the most resilient in terms of maintaining an equilibrium or maintaining a continuity, mainly because culture is so dependent upon religion. And I believe that the religious traditions in America, while they've changed, are at a fairly basic level persisting and consistent, and therefore basic culture doesn't change all that much. The challenges certainly come up, but the culture is pretty resilient, I believe.
Pat Buchanan ran for president some years back, sounding the alarm on the culture war. His term has been taken up, and obviously now is the coin of the realm. Do you think it is a war, and if so, where are the battle lines drawn?
Well, it is a struggle. I believe there are both, to use the words of James Davis and Hunter, the University of Virginia sociologist who has talked about the culture wars. He says it's a struggle between the traditionalist or the orthodox is what on the one side, and on the other side you get progressives or the revisionists. And in between, however, perhaps the vast majority of people who kind of muddle along, coping with change, but pretty much staying within the tradition. But then you get the progressives that want to change and revise the culture. And one could say not only the American culture, the social culture, but also the culture and the teachings within the church. And then you get the Orthodox and the traditionalists who believe that something unchanging has been revealed in the religious and the Christian tradition that we shouldn't bargain away, even in spite of the great changes in culture.
How does the Christian individually and then the Christian church, how does it steer the ship between the rocks on the one side, which would be kind of a jingoistic view of culture,
mm-hmm.
and the rocks on the other side, which is what is being called for in many sectors, and that is just open and uncritical multiculturalism.
Well, I believe the best way to maintain our sanity on this thing is to constantly draw upon the wells of biblical wisdom, but also upon the great wells of religious or Christian tradition throughout the ages. And if we look at those wells and we look at those traditions, we know that things change and that things develop, but it's always usually within the tradition itself that they find resources for change. For example, women's rights and the role of women in the church and in society, one can find in the Bible itself elements and themes that really dignify and elevate women to equality with men, the way that Jesus taught related to women, for example. And in many ways, the life within the church doesn't catch up to the revelation of God in these in the Bible for many, many centuries. But finally, it does grasp some of these elements. But that creates change in the Christian tradition, and then it also creates change in the larger tradition. So I think the most wholesome thing is to find our sources of change, not so much in the society itself, but it, within resources within our own tradition.
Does the church have a culture of its own, and is that different than the culture that it lives in as an entity in society?
Excellent question. Well, the church always has culture-forming capacities, and I like to talk about tradition, a Christian tradition, as an argument that sustained itself over many centuries. It's socially embodied and narrative-based, based upon the Bible. But it carries within it not only a vision that is theologically grounded and articulated, but it also carries and is constituted by and expresses practices like the Eucharist, like marriage, like prayer, like personal devotion, like hymn singing. All of these things, it seems to me, bear a great deal of rich weight from the past that can be brought to bear on the current culture. And it's that kind of rich embodiment of a tradition that I think is so wholesome when churches are faithful to their tradition and form their young in it. That will train them to move into the culture, to take what is good out of the culture, and to shun what is evil, and to do good transforming of the culture itself. That is, we can be leaven in the culture, wholesome leaven, not just accommodating to whatever the culture is doing.
Well, then, here again is a difficult question. When the road runs the other direction and the culture becomes the guide of the church, or when a church even consciously says we are going to let the culture call the shots on anything from how we worship to what we believe to what sort of an ethic we project back into the mm-hmm. culture. Your thoughts on this?
Well, then I think you get what Richard Niebuhr called Christ of culture, and you begin to lose the specificity and the great inheritance that has come from the revelation of God passed down throughout the centuries. So what you have today, it seems to me, is a lot of mainline denominations that over the years have so accommodated to certain sectors of culture that they no longer have a whole lot to say. There's not anything specific in them. The good, great news of the gospel and the cutting edge of the law of God both are missing, and they begin to diminish because what they offer can be got in other places in the culture. I mean, if you want to get into liberationist efforts, it's better to join a voluntary association rather than to try to do through the church. Or if you want to be political, join a political party and not worry about the stodgy people in the church who are likely to impede your political ideas. So I think there's a leaching out of the substance of the Christian tradition as it accommodates too much to culture, and its people will begin to drift away because it really doesn't have anything to offer them.
One of the watchwords in the culture, and then it's found its way, of course, into the church, is diversity. Oh. And it's treated as a self-evident good, is it?
Oh, heavens no. That drives me crazy. It has reached the level of a mantra. All you have to say is diversity, and people fall down and worship it. No, I have a little article in the book called Down with Diversity, and that's kind of flip, but what I mean by that is that people are not careful about what kinds of diversity they want and what kinds they don't want. That is, what kind of diversities we ought to aim at and what kind we don't want, because it's totally thoughtless to think that the increase of diversity will lead to good. A short right-hand way of putting it, on the first principles of life, we don't want a lot of diversity. We want a good deal of agreement in the church and even in the society. But we can celebrate the diversity of cultures. We can celebrate diversity in race and other categories. All that's wholesome, I think. But we certainly don't want diversity at the fundamental levels of principle.
Then, with less than a minute, your final essay in this book, Reasonable Ethics, is titled America the Okay. What did you mean to say in here about our society, since we're talking about the Christian's place in society? Ours is the American society.
Well, I think I was responding to an analysis of America that made it sound like things were just peachy keen, and Americans were simply pretty comfortable within this society. And whether that's true of the general society or not, I don't think it ever ought to be true of Christians. We know that God's will and God and the vision of God transcend whatever society we're in, and we should live somewhat uncomfortably in this society, and on several fronts. One, on the front of culture that we've talked about before, we should also live uncomfortably when we have as many poor people as we have, many people who are not able to flourish in the society. So Christians, it seems, armed with the vision of God that we get from the Bible, the vision of the kingdom of God, the vision of Christ's reigning over our hearts and minds, always ought to be a pilgrim people that are critical. They participate in the society, but they critically participate. They're in, but not of, this world.
Dr. Robert Benny is Professor Emeritus of Religion and Director of the Center for Religion and Society at Roanoke College. He's authored Our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for June, Reasonable Ethics. Dr. Benny, thanks for being our guest.
Thank you very much for all the great questions.
This book, Reasonable Ethics, is available either at our website, issuesetc.org. You'll find the book there right on our homepage, issuesetc.org. Or if you call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours, you can ask about Reasonable Ethics, a Christian approach to social, economic, and political concerns. Their toll-free number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.